As an erupting political crisis grips Washington, many of America's newspapers are responding with what they do best, or at least what they always used to do best, long-form, critical analysis and asking tough questions every day. But which papers are leading the way? And with eroding trust in many of the traditional legal and political safeguards, is the American newspaper more important now than ever? That's coming up today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Later in the programme, we'll cross to Kiev, where our very own Eurovision correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, is getting ready for this year's contest the only way he knows how, at the local newsstand.
It's a pro-Russian newspaper, and the idea of success of this newspaper is that this newspaper, they are giving it for free near the underground stations. That's why people, mostly poor people or elderly people, are taking it and reading, but they are extremely popular.
But first, shockwaves are still rippling through Washington and around the world, indeed, following the US president's sudden dismissal of FBI Director James Comey at the start of the week. For many in America's newspaper industry, the extraordinary development recalled another incident which saw journalism and politics collide. Watergate back in the early 70s. I'm joined today by John Owen, chairman of the Frontline Club and retired professor of international journalism at City University. John, good to speak with you as always. Extraordinary turbulent times in politics, in the printed media. Let's look at another pretty extraordinary week, viz. President Trump. And the questions about the legal mechanisms that exist, the checks and balances, that's kind of continuing to unfold. Where does journalism sit? What's the role of the newspapers when it comes to attempting at least to reveal what the Trump White House is doing to hold them to account? I mean, the media is as or more important than ever, right?
Absolutely. And everyone thought, well, with Trump coming in and the attempt to kind of broaden the definition of media, we suddenly have Breitbart dictating the storyline. No, in fact, the mainline media, our most venerated newspapers, are leading the charge. And we've never seen such inspired reporting, at least for a long time. It has like been a shockwave that has awakened journalism. We should thank Donald Trump. He should be given the Courage in Journalism Award for thanking him for waking people up.
So is this, in a way, he's stumbled on his own constant repetition of this notion of fake news and challenging veracity because it's made the reader more interested in that very thing? Is this true? Who's making the story? What are the sources? And they're asking trenchant questions about that, and that's aiding the whole process. Did you expect it to go that way? I don't know. I worried a little bit in his early days that he would be so cynical and so aggressive that maybe the middle of the road readers might switch off and start to question everything. But you think it's definitely having a broader positive effect?
Well, I do. And also what's really changed, and I give the newspaper industry some credit for this, is they're not just publishing online several times a day. They're not just printing their newspapers. They're going on the airwaves, on podcasts. I'm a faithful listener to the New York Times, The Daily, The Washington Post. Can he do that? They rushed out a special edition yesterday. Can he fire the director of the FBI? And The Daily will be speaking to a reporter who's just been filing and take you through his sourcing or her sourcing. It's brilliant. And they're pushing how journalism works out there to combat fake news. I think that's one of the conscious decisions that's been made, and I think it's a very intelligent one.
And how will Trump react? Because it was interesting. You read a lot of reports. There's anecdotal suggestions that, for example, post the Comey firing, he was rather taken aback by the fact that papers, rather than saying Trump fires incompetent Comey, all the headlines were, in the midst of Russia inquiry, stunning news as Trump fires FBI director. Do you think he'll have to reconsider? Do you think he will reconsider? We know how bloody-minded he is. Will he try and open a new front, or is he just going to have to accept that the media can and will do the job to hold him to account?
Well, you know, as we know, he has amnesia. I mean, what happened yesterday is nothing today. He'll pick up the phone and he'll invite Glenn Thrush and Maggie Haberman in. He'll talk to the CBS News. I mean, he loves the attention. So I think he's completely oblivious to what impact is. I would say Sean Spicer's career, if it was ever imperiled, looks even more imperiled because again, I think Trump is saying, what kind of a West Wing operation do we have going here? You had an hour to push out information. There's Sean Spicer standing in the driveway asking the media to turn their lights off, trying to make sense of this. I mean, it's pathetic. And he goes off to his reserve duty and leaves Huckabee Sanders there to celebrate the birthday of her daughter and try to make sense of all this. I mean, again, it's theater. It's 24-hour guerrilla theater here. It's unbelievable.
It is, and it's providing an extraordinary ammunition, I guess, for the newspapers. If we come back to that, you've already mentioned a couple of specific examples where papers have been taking their process apart, have been going across platform very successfully. How do they build on this opportunity then? Do they just have to stick to their guns? Do they just have to make sure that they're not antagonized by the sorts of inflammatory statements they get from Trump? How do papers build on this opportunity if it is such a chance?
First of all, I think they need to keep doing what they're doing. But remember, we're really looking at this through the prism of this matters to the chattering classes. If I were to go back to where I grew up in Huntington, Indiana, as I did in the middle of the campaign last summer, they wouldn't give any concern to all this reporting. They'd still be listening to their talk radio guy. They'd be listening to Rush Limbaugh. They'd still be watching Fox News, and they'd still think the fake news is out to get him regardless of what he does. And they'd take on board the reverse spin from Sean Hannity and everybody out there who is trying to counter this, saying, well, they would say that. I mean, here he is trying to get rid of the man who treated Hillary Clinton so poorly. So, I mean, again, we're really talking now about the kind of things that they talk about in salons. I mean, this is not the reality of Trump America. I don't think they're turning on him at all.
So what do papers do then? Does it filter down the kind of food chain to regional titles? You know, how perilous their positions can be. Maybe they don't feel that they can ask the tough questions because maybe they need to keep advertisers happy, so on and so forth. But how do papers address that more fundamental problem? Or is ultimately it's not their sole responsibility?
I don't think they can. I mean, I think local papers are going to continue, depending upon the politics of where they are. If they're in the heartland and they're part of Trump territory, they're going to continue to give him support. And again, as we know, newspapers in some of these areas don't matter as much as talk radio and Fox News.
Well, speaking of Fox News, I did want to ask you too about Mr. Rupert Murdoch, Donald Trump's political turmoil roiling away. Murdoch himself has some tough challenges ahead. He's no stranger, of course, to those sorts of dynamics. Let's look here in the UK. Murdoch's interested in taking over the Sky pay TV and news broadcasting company, in which it already has a stake. There's questions about a fit and proper person test. The regulator can look at that. There's lots of controversy, not just dating back to what his print newspapers did or didn't do over the last, 20-odd years, but particularly, again, about the problems at Fox News with Bill O'Reilly and all this sort of thing. Given the O'Reilly controversy and seemingly Murdoch's knowledge of that, Roger Ailes formerly as well, and again, his knowledge of that, could he be judged a fit and proper person by UK regulatory standards, do you think?
Well, I don't think he should be. I mean, again, his organization has sat on the charges of sexual and racial harassment for years only because the story got broken by the New York Times and his hand got forced that anybody take any decisions within Fox to hold those accountable for doing this stuff. It's exactly the parallel with what happened with phone hacking here. I mean, after all, Millie Dowler happened in 2002. Nothing was done inside any of the newspapers he owned, including News of the World, until The Guardian broke the story. Only after The Guardian humiliated Murdoch and his papers, including News of the World, did he pull the plug on News of the World. He has a long history of just doing nothing, or the people who work for him do nothing until they're exposed. Now, of course, the point's being argued, they're trying to make the case that, well, we have media plurality here now, so they're not as much of a dynamic presence as they were, and therefore, just because he owns the Times, the Sunday Times, and the Sun, there are so many other outlets. Look at Facebook and look at the other influences. In fact, that's a specious argument because, as we know, people go to their own newspaper of preference online through Facebook. But he's got to counter something else that's really happened here. You've got lawyers representing 20 potential harassment suits here appearing at Ofcom. You've got Lisa Bloom, the lawyer with Wendy Walsh, who really was the fatal blow against Bill O'Reilly, here testifying. But will anything happen? I don't know. I think, again, we're looking at the prospect of an overwhelming Tory majority. Theresa May needs the Murdoch press to keep pushing the Brexit line to make sure that keeps going. Do they want to alienate Rupert Murdoch? I mean, I think the power politics inside, you know, he's going to continue. You know, she goes to New York for 36 hours. Who did she see? Rupert Murdoch.
So let's say hypothetically that the deal goes ahead, the Sky takeover deal, certainly the buyout. Does that change public perception? Or there still seems to me to be something of a disconnect in terms of the public view between Murdoch, the newspaper proprietor, which has its own dynamic, its own history, going back to the Wapping days and the battles of the print unions and all this, and Murdoch, the media, the broadcast proprietor. People seem to have a different attitude about, oh, well, yes, this is the ravings of Fox News. But they seem to look very differently at, say, reading the Times of London. Do you think that's true? And if the deal went ahead, would that force people to confront some more contradictions that exist there?
I mean, again, how sophisticated are people in knowing that Murdoch owns both the Times and the Sun and the Sunday Times? I think several things are kind of interesting that are going on. One is, back in the U.S., one of those who's the best sources on what is going on in terms of a potential Justice Department investigation into Fox News is a guy named Joe Flint, the media writer for the Wall Street Journal, owned by Rupert Murdoch. Now, it seems to me inconceivable that this could possibly jeopardize everything going on here and that Murdoch hasn't tried to stop him. But so far, I heard the guy on Reliable Sources on CNN, and he was asked this question, and he said, well, so far, I mean, the bar is very high for getting this information in, and would Jeff Sessions and the Justice Department ever really prosecute his favorite network? I don't know. But then over here, remembering going back to Millie Dowler, the minute that James Harding, who was then editor of the Times, wrote critical leaders about the hacking, he was both attacked by Murdoch, apparently, according to Nick Davies in his book, and then ousted as editor of the Times. So that's interesting to see whether or not revenge is taken on those who dissent from the public Murdoch line.
So, roll back again, early 2000s, you mentioned the phone hacking scandal and all this. Has there been any meaningful progress? You know, you're a veteran newsman, Johnny.
No.
Do you despair then about what happens next? What's the solution?
I think things are going to just roll along as they are, given the nature of politics here, unless we have a Macron moment, unless suddenly...
Doesn't seem like it at the minute, does it?
Unless they suddenly realign the political parties here, and I don't... That's possible, maybe, after what's probably going to be a slaughter of labor. Again, look at the media's coverage of Jeremy Corbyn today, you know, and his kind of Russian hat. And I mean, they're just mocking him today. I mean, again, sort of putting aside what's good or bad about him. I know. I think I have a feeling, first of all, that ultimately this Sky deal will probably go through. And you still will have the date. You know, if you looked at Brexit, the circulation of 6.5 million, 5.5 million were all pro-Brexit. So I think, again, a big majority for May, probably going to keep her hands off the press that's going to continue to support her in a big way. And on the regulation side, Leveson 2 will probably never happen. That's already been kicked into the long grass. And is she really going to deal with that? She's going to dismiss it on the grounds of finance. But I can't see Leveson 2 is supposed to get to the relationship between newspapers and parties and traditional influence. That's never going to happen. So you're left with ipso, the replacement of the Press Complaints Commission acting as a complaints center.
Well, John, look, I want to try and end on an upbeat note. It may be difficult,
given
some
of
the broad themes we found. But let's go back. You know, I mentioned you, professor of journalism formerly at City here in London. I think I've asked you this before. You know, you'd see these hungry tyro hacks in there, and they'd say, I've got all these big ambitions, and I still love the printed word, and all this kind of thing. Would you still be able to tell a young trainee, I don't know, a 21-year-old kid, look, it is a great profession. You can affect change. You can bring down people who are corrupt. You can shape the political narratives. Or would you have to advise them to be slightly more circumspect, realistic, maybe downplay their expectations about what their journalism could achieve?
Not at all. And we're just talking about what the outlets are. So, I mean, obviously, if they can get to the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, more power to them. And the other great thing is you don't have to be a broadcaster anymore. I get far more information from working intelligent reporters on these podcasts and listening to them, say, on Morning Joe, than I ever get from trained package reporters. And my history is broadcast journalism. My daughter is working for Vice.com and breaking story after story. I go on to Vox to find out what the analysis of the reporting was, or onto BuzzFeed, or onto Politico, or any of these other outlets. I was just looking at the Atlantic Monthly, reading what David Frum had. There are so many really intelligent outlets that are out there. And if you're a good reporter and a hustler and willing to work your tail off, there is a lot of work out there to pursue. Not in the traditional way in which you're going to be developed. You're not going to get a career as I got with my old CBC. But I think it's a pretty exciting time.
There you go. See, we found a chink of light in amongst all that gloom. John, good to speak with you as always. Thanks for coming to see us.
Pleasure.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Off to Kiev next. And now to Kiev, where Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco is covering Eurovision for us. We all know how much he loves magazines. Almost as much as Eurovision, in fact. Of course, he stopped by at a Kiev newsstand to see what's selling and how the print media scene in the country is faring. He's joined by local Andrei Bashtovoy, who's also editor-in-chief of the local city guide, The Village Ukraine.
They don't read much of such a media, so they read on the internet, they like TV, but mostly we wouldn't have, like, you know, some kind of New York Times of Ukraine. We wouldn't have this national newspaper, which is responsible, which is, has higher authority in Ukraine, and which, like, everybody believes that it's doing the right thing. We have some things with the magazines. I'll show you interesting story over here. So look at this. Here is Correspondent, and it was like one of the most popular Ukrainian magazine. Like, everybody was reading news over there, like in this magazine. But after that, during our previous president who left the country after the revolution, one of the pro-presidential oligarchs bought it, and this was pretty popular, good magazine. I love this magazine. I always read this magazine. But after that, it became pro-presidential, anti-oppositional, and it was like it lost the quality. And the most interesting idea that it left its team. So the team of this magazine left, and they founded the Novoe Vreme. It's a New Time magazine. And now they are some kind of correspondent of that time. So now they are the best in this area, I think, is like on my belief.
And it's quite a nice international cover they have with Macron on top of the Eiffel Tower. So clearly they're covering a lot of the French elections. Tell us the name again of this magazine.
It's Novoe Vreme. It's New Time.
And of course, there's a little note on Eurovision Song Contest being hosted in Ukraine. But Andrei, let's go through all the titles. I can see there's L'Officiel, so...
Over here we have Vogue, we have Harper's Bazaar, we have Elle, we have Cosmopolitan.
And they're all the Ukrainian titles, the Ukrainian international titles.
Actually, that's all. So we have Focus, and we had Forbes, but in Ukraine it's a bit difficult to talk about the print media, because all the medias in Ukraine, or almost all the medias in Ukraine, are owned by some oligarchs. So some rich people who are trying to influence, because they are rich, trying to influence on politicians who are owners of, like, not official, but owners of some political parties. And that's why if you're like telling about some magazine, you need to tell who's an owner. Before you know the owner, you don't have to believe this magazine. In Ukraine, you need to filter all the news even more than during political campaign of Trump, or during presidential election in the US, because that time it was concentrated in a year. In Ukraine, we are living in such an atmosphere, in such a media background for 25 years. And that's why it's a bit difficult. But like here, you can buy some crosswords. They were popular during, or here is, I don't know who reads it actually, but it's like the magazine about Ukrainian vyshivanka, it's traditional Ukrainian dress.
I would like to read that.
Yeah, and there is a cooking magazine, so everything like about some kind of lifestyle thing, but they are not always high quality, but I don't know, if they are selling that, somebody's buying them. We had Ukrainian, there was a problem, you cannot find Ukrainian National Geographic, because during the year we had one. But because the economical reason they were not economically successful, they closed. That's why, like, there was a magazine which I was reading. Same thing with the Esquire. You won't find Ukrainian Esquire because during 2 years in Ukraine we had it, but now it's closed because of economical reasons, because after, like, on before the revolution, like the first year month of the revolution was the last month of Ukrainian Esquire, and that was the best magazine on my belief of that time, and you won't find it here.
What about the newspapers? I mean, you did mention before that Ukraine doesn't have a kind of very respected newspaper, but tell us, what are the main national dailies here in Ukraine?
It's Sivodnya, owned by oligarch Akhmetov, who was the richest person in Ukraine, and who is responsible for what we have, for war, what we have on the Ukrainian East. But his newspaper is still popular, and a lot of people I saw that are buying this newspaper near the underground stations. It's Vesti, it's founded, and their editors, so it's a pro-Russian newspaper, and the idea of success of this newspaper is that this newspaper, they are giving it for free near the underground stations. That's why people, mostly poor people or elderly people, are taking it and reading, but they are extremely popular. They like all this mass audience is reading this newspaper, so that's why they're influential in Ukraine. But if you read it, like, sitting next to professional Ukrainian journalist who will explain you what does it mean and about all this manipulation inside, you'll be shocked, believe me. And here is Vysoky Zamok. It's a newspaper from Lviv. It's a pretty strange situation that we found it in Kyiv, but it's a Lviv newspaper, which is possible to find here. And there is a lot of, like, newspapers, like daughters of Russian newspapers, like Argumenty i Fakty, it's Arguments and Facts. Gazeta po-ukrainsky, it's Ukrainian newspaper. It's a bit difficult because, like, when you're working in media, it's a bit difficult for you to talk about that because you know all this inside things, all these things, all this manipulation, all this low-quality information, all the speculations, and sometimes propaganda, or sometimes, I don't know, some political PR, hidden political advertisement inside this newspaper. So that's why I will give some advice as what to read in Ukraine. Better read Ukrainian books, they are great.
Well, but what about, do you have a scene of perhaps more indie magazines, like independent publications?
I'm trying to find one. We have a magazine called Shaw. It means some kind of what, and they are publishing a lot of interesting materials. They are publishing a lot of counterculture, literature, some interesting design stuff. They always have great covers, and I'm shocked that I can't find it here, because when I was at university, in this newsstand, I was always buying this magazine, but now I can't find it.
Maybe it's sold out.
Perhaps, I hope so, because it's pretty... Oh, no, it's here, actually.
Yeah.
Over here, it's not sold out, it's Shaw
magazine. Amazing cover.
Yeah, but, like, it's not the best one, but you like it if you read it.
I might get this one for me as well, about the Ukrainian dress.
Okay, but better not do this. Run away.
Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco reporting from Kyiv, where he's covering Eurovision for us. And, of course, all will be revealed later today. Finally, on the stack, we head to Germany for a look at a selected weekly title from the newsstand. The debate continues in Germany over the country's national cultural identity and how migration is affecting it and will do in the future. The country's interior minister has formalised a 10-point definition of its Leitkultur, or leading culture, hinting that immigrants need to adapt better to local custom. It's a debate that's been ranging for years, but what is the leading culture, and does such a coherent and catch-all notion really even exist? Alexander Gerlach is a visiting scholar at Harvard, an op-ed contributor to the New York Times. He recently wrote about this very issue in Germany's leading business weekly, Wirtschaftswoche. He spoke to Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli.
Well, this year, Germany has a federal election, and the Conservative Party, of course, as Conservative parties tend to be, feel inclined to be the patron saint, so to speak, of a home, of fatherland and all these conservative values. And I think in the context of the refugee crisis from 2 years ago, this is the context in which the minister operates.
Why does he think it's necessary, though? I mean, why now to have this conversation?
Well, on a general note, in many Western European countries, you had over the last 10, 15 years, one debate or the other about what it means to be German, to be English, to be French. And I guess this is a, you can call this period of time in which we live, our descendants may call it an age of identity. That's what I at least tend to call it, because you find in all these societies a need for redefinition or definition who we are. And actually, in my opinion, since you ask this only on a national level, which to me, a national identity is somewhat an artificial construct, it doesn't make me wonder that we didn't come up in 17 years, this is how long the debate runs in Germany, haven't come up with a solution or a proper answer.
So what's been the history of the debate within Germany, the leading culture debate? How far back does it really stretch?
Well, in German, it's called Leitkultur, and it started with a debate. The term is by a political scientist, but it was picked up by a conservative politician, Friedrich Merz, in 2000, I believe. And it's been basically the debate about what makes us German. And basically, the Bavarians, they may have an answer to that, and the people in Hamburg may have an answer to that. That may slightly differ. So I would always argue this, the Germany, like many, like look into Spain, for instance, or the United Kingdom, for that matter, has a variety of identities. But the wish of the Conservative Party to come up with a one and only definition about Germanness that then may also merge into immigration tests, so people that seek to stay in Germany for longer time. I think that is the context in which this arose 17 years ago. And it always has, and it has in many European countries, a context to Muslim immigration, to immigration from Muslim majority countries.
And of course, I'm sure attitudes towards different ethnic groups within the country differs according to where you are in Germany. I mean, north, south, east, west, they probably all have different attitudes towards the other.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is like we have xenophobic barometers every year, and there is like Bavaria and Sachsen-Anhalt. They rank rather high. Rheinland-Pfalz, where I'm from, is rather low. I'm always happy about that. And of course, this depends. I mean, who makes that wonder? Like the countries who have more foreigners or are used to having tourists and foreigners, for that matter, they tend to have less negative attitudes. Whereas you go to Saxonia, where you have 2% of the population being foreigners, and you have movements like Pegida sparking.
How closely does the average German adhere to German values, and how strongly do they identify with European values? Are they a German first, then European, or the other way around?
Oh, well, I mean, this depends on where you go, and there are surveys about that. Just to highlight this a bit, like a few years ago, the former president of the Republic, Christian Wulff, he said in a speech, Islam belongs to Germany. This created a public outcry. And basically people then would say, like, on one hand, I would say, no, we are founded on Christian values. We are founded on humanist values and the Enlightenment. And historically, Islam is not part of our culture, which is basically true if you look into historic terms. But if you look at the present and the future, we have a Muslim minority, up to 3.5 million people, mostly from Turkey, of Turkish origins. So you can see an overlap of values that are perceived as German or European. And it's also no secret that Germany, after the Second World War, with all the cruelty and the horror and the crime of the Holocaust, was happy to be reinvited into the group of civilized nations, and the European Union was quite much a vehicle for the Germans. So you may still find high approval rates for the European Union in general. And I guess there is no perception whatsoever that European values and German values wouldn't be quite the same.
That was Alexander Gerlach speaking to Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli. And that's all for this week's programme. Thanks to our producers, Ben Ryland, and from Ukraine, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thanks to all of our editorial team. Comments or queries are welcome. Write to Fernando. He's on fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for tuning in.